Hi, it's me, Terry Tenseth. Today we have a special program that's kind of on the fly. I was contacted by a promotions director about an incredible individual named Immaculée, who was one of 16 women that survived the Rwanda genocide. I'm going to go straight to our phone interview that we had just moments earlier, and we're bringing it to you so you can better understand what happened back in 1994 and hear Immaculée's incredible story of survival and how it's changed her life. You're listening to KQAL. I have Immaculée Elibigiza on the phone with us today to tell us about her incredible story of survival and how it's changed her life. Now, Immaculée, back in 1994, the genocide in Rwanda had taken place, and the Hutu tribes sought to torture and kill the Tutsis, and you're a Tutsi. Why was this? What event happened that caused all of a sudden this genocide to take place?
You know, it is really the same thing like you would think of what happened to the Jews.
Right.
It was the tribes were created at the time of colonialization. The Belgians, when they colonized the country, they created, literally created two tribes. They divided people into two tribes. People with different shape of the nose became one tribe. The others with this size of the nose, size of the height, became one tribe. To a point where even among brothers, some of them became Hutu, others became Tutsis. So from that moment on, they started to use the tribes to push ideas. So if like they want an idea that is going to be loved by this place, they will say, oh, the other tribe is bad. They always think they're this, they're that. And then the whole tribe will think, oh, they're attacking us then. If the other tribe hates it, then we have to love it. You know what they call divide and conquer. So that word was created by the time of colonialization. So when the colony left the country, the new leaders continued to use it. It was almost like political parties, you know, at the time of election, like, you know, Republican and Democrats, how things heat up a little bit.
Right.
That way it became. So by the time of the genocide, the Tutsis who were refugees outside, they were asking the government to let them come back inside, to give them the same rights as everybody, as the Hutu. And they were really pushing, and they have started to fight at the border because the Hutu who had the power, they used force, and they blocked the borders. They never let anyone to come in. So at one time, the leaders inside who were Hutus, and they said, you know, if you keep pushing us to welcome you, we are going to kill your brothers inside the country. And they prepared that, and they made it happen, killed more than 1 million people in a period of 3 months.
And it just happened overnight, all of a sudden, the killing? I mean, we're talking like neighbors were pitted against neighbors.
You are great, because all of us, even before the genocide, when we knew they were preparing that, I remember thinking, how? How can that start? It's crazy. They're just talking, but they were pushing, trying to make people see each other different. Because people loved one another as Rwandans. But every single day, there was a radio that belonged to the government that used to tell people how Tutsis are bad. They think they're tall. They think they're smart. They think they're this. They're not human beings. They're cockroaches. And they will be laughing about that. One day we are going to kill them. And even other Hutu friends were like, that's crazy. We can never kill other people. So the way how it started, it seems like the president who was on power, who was a Hutu, they asked him to start killing people. And he said, no, if you kill people, it's going to be on my name. I am the president. Mm-hmm. You know what they did? They killed him, make it to have an excuse that the Tutsi killed him, then killed them. He died on the 7th of April at night. The first 2 hours after he was killed, 18 families were killed. They were killing like 10 people, 10 kids and mom and dad, 8 kids and mom and dad and grandma and grandma. And of course, as you know, and I remember one time my father said, they never killed the whole family. They always killed like somebody who they suspected he was involved in politics, who wanted politics, but not the whole family. And of course, that's why they call it a genocide. A genocide is an attempt to kill a whole group of people, a race or religion, people or a tribal. They prepared it for like 3 years, how they will kill everybody so that they don't have to have any challenge anymore. And it is just started by the killing of the president, and then they got crazy, like, oh, Tutsis killed our president. And then they start killing babies, Tutsis.
And they did it with these long swords or knives, actually, and it was really inhumane. There is nothing.
It's so bad. They did that like a year before the genocide started, and this is in the report of United Nations that was in the country. They bought thousands and thousands, millions of machetes from China, and they were killing by machete. This is what I really hard in my understanding. I understand you want to kill somebody. Why not shoot them?
Right.
Why have to torture them? The people who were killing us were friends, neighbors.
It doesn't make sense why that mode was chosen. The only thing I could think of is if it was ritualistic for some reason to choose that mode.
Yeah.
Or economical, like they didn't want people to pay for guns or bullets. That's the only thing I could think of. Or to be just downright cruel, as cruel can be in it.
It was cruel. It's almost like somebody holding somebody's child just so that they can get to the father. Yeah. So it was cruel, it was economical, because they didn't have, for sure, enough money to buy guns.
Mm-hmm.
But it was criminal. They have to hype their anger to be able to kill an innocent person. You have to convince yourself that you are doing a good thing. They gave every Rwandan a machete to be able to do it. And of course, not everyone did it. Not even half of the Hutus. The Hutus are not bad people as the tribe. But the government, the leaders who were in power, they used it. And of course, like in every country, we have prisons. You will find people who will follow you if you want to do that. As long as especially you have money and you have the government behind you. Yeah. So many great Hutus, like a guy who hid me. There were many. I still have many best friends Hutus.
And now, if you were found to be hiding a Tutsi and you were Hutu, they would either, I believe from what I had researched, would make you kill the people that you were harboring, right? And then possibly kill the person who was protecting.
Yeah, that's exactly it. They would do that. They will kill you or they will let you kill people. Other times, they might not kill you because they didn't find many people and they didn't kill them. But there is a man I remember, is actually so funny. This man was a Muslim guy. He said, like, in his belief, that he won't let people kill people in his family who they found. And then when he gave them a hard time from killing the people he was hiding, they told him, we will kill you first if you don't let us kill them. And he said, okay, you start with him, but I cannot see their blood. And they shot him. Yeah, he was a hero in the country for sure.
Definitely. Now, the man that hid you, he also hid a number of women, right? And he was Hutu, and I mean, he took a big risk.
And, huge, yeah.
Yes, going ahead and protecting you ladies. Now, how many were there of you?
We were 8 people in this tiny bathroom, 3 by 4 feet.
That is tiny.
It's really tiny. I mean, the youngest was 7 years old, and she was sitting over us.
She would have to in order to get in there. Now,
yes.
I'm thinking of this now. Were you the first one to go into hiding? Because your dad told you to go over to the priest's house for hiding, and then did the others follow?
You know, it's so funny. I think what happened was, when some people came in the house of the pastor, I don't know when they got there. I mean, I went to hide as the first person in my family, and first person in the group where I was. But the girls who came to hide by this man, I didn't know them. They came from different villages. So when I met them in the bathroom, I didn't know if they were there before, if they were in another room. If you were a Tutsi, you wanted to fit anywhere you can. Maybe they were under the beds for maybe a day or two. But when we went in the bathroom, it was like 3 in the morning. He took me there, he went back, he brought 5 more women. Yeah, so I don't know where he got them from, really.
How long were you in the bathroom hiding in this care?
We were there for 3 months, 91 days, without talking, no speaking, completely quiet. We didn't know when it was going to end. No one else in the house knew, except the man who was hiding us, and his children didn't know. But later he told two of his children.
Did that create any problems for you in hiding?
No, the two children were really beautiful. Some of his kids were not trustworthy at all. But these two were really great. I mean, I think at a certain time, actually, they saved our lives. There is a time this man told us that he was really tired. He was scared. Because they were coming to look for us over and over. And he was scared that they would find us. So one time he said, you know, I think I cannot keep them anymore. He told his two kids. And I heard later that the two kids told him, Dad, you can't do that. Otherwise, you will not forgive yourself. How can you live with yourself if they kill them in front of the door? Mm-hmm. He said, you kept them, let them kill them here, but don't be the one to send them out. Wow. In a way, they saved our lives, yeah.
Definitely. And there was a time that there were members of the Hutu in the house searching for you, and it got really close there for a while.
I know. They came to 300 people, my dear, 300 people. Dressed in banana leaves, neighbors, people I went to school with, having machetes, guns, long spears. They came inside the house, searching any place you can think of, in a house of 4-bedroom. And they stopped right at the door of the bathroom. They searched everywhere, in the ceiling, under the beds, closet, on the top of the house. After searching everywhere, the only door they didn't open was the bathroom.
And why do you think that was?
That's really where I come to believe in God. And of course, I mean, God would do anything to save anyone. You know, people can call it luck, you know, or maybe because there's no coincidence. I don't believe that. And there is a mission for everyone, even the dying. But I didn't want to die. I was begging God in my heart, please don't let them kill me today. I know everyone died at a certain time. Mm-hmm. And I know many people who died when they were asking God, just let me die today. I don't want this anymore. So I was begging God, don't let me die today. And they came and they didn't. So the reason for me is I do really know that God is real. He heard my prayer. I try to do the best in my life today because I think if he heard my prayer and saved me then, I'm going to die one day. What can I do today? To share my story, to teach the lesson I have learned throughout, how to live this life, what really matters in this life. How do we avoid those kind of things to happen? By avoiding today, by considering and looking in our hearts and see when we get angry, when we hate that we step into creating a genocide around us.
That's where it starts.
Yeah, it started by getting angry and forgiving somebody, trying to revenge, wishing somebody to hurt, to go through something.
These 3 to 4 months, you must have lived in horrible fear, you and all the ladies. And at least you had each other at that time. But even though you had your faith, were there times where you're like, this is it, it's going to be over?
Every single day, we didn't know if we were going to survive 1 hour for 3 months. That 3 months were like 100 years. Every single day for not 1 hour, we were okay that, oh, at least we are peaceful now. We expected the killers to show up anytime. They were paid by the government. They had food, they had drinks. All their job was to go home by home to search. So we heard them passing through the door. We heard them coming. And every time, like, this is it. They're coming here. And no matter how much I prayed and I can trust, like, God, I know you are here. Anytime they came to the door, I was frozen. I was dead. I was like, this is it. And I will again just hold on to that trust inside. And somehow, again, they will go without seeing us.
And during this time, you're trapped there and you're in this tiny bathroom. I had seen that sometimes you ladies would come out of the bathroom into this small room, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
And you were able to lay down, but you had to stay without a sight because there was a window, right? So this is like a small bedroom and you're all laying on the floor with each other. And I think what people don't realize is that you didn't shower, you hardly eat anything because
definitely
right. And I think you yourself started out as 115 pounds and at the end of it you were at like 65 pounds.
I know we ate only the food of the leftovers of the kids they put in the garbage. And not that he wanted to give us a bad food. That's what he could afford.
Right.
Yeah. And when I came out, I was a skeleton. Every bone I can count them. The first doctor who saw me, he told me that there's no way I can ever live normal. He said, every organ is dry. There's no way you're going to be. And I remember grabbing to my rosary, my prayer, my father had given me, and I told him, there's no way. God saved me. He's going to save me from the sicknesses too.
Because you're perfectly healthy now, aren't you?
I am really healthy. At least so far, I have never had any sickness that come from that, from anything. I mean, I fall down, I cut myself, but I haven't had any type of sickness like that.
How have the other ladies fared?
They are doing good. One of us died.
Okay.
She had some type of sickness. She died. Others, one of us is not doing too great. She loses her mind, I mean, her memory easily.
Uh-huh.
And not only what happened during the genocide, but even today. Things can happen like yesterday. She would completely not have any idea what it was.
Okay.
So she had been looking for doctors, but it looks like nothing is helping much.
That's sad.
Yeah, poor thing. She was the one who was 7 years old. Others, are doing great.
I think when you're that young and something like that happens, it does really affect you.
Yeah, this is a poor thing. For 3 months, she never cried. She only sat anywhere we told her to sit. She never said a word when we were searching. She could have screamed.
Wow.
And to control herself that much, she must have shut down something.
When you came out of hiding, technically at what you were still hiding, you had left at what, 2 or 3 a.m. in the morning to go to a village nearby, wasn't it? That was considered a safe haven. All of a sudden after the 3 months, you were going to leave the priest's home.
Yes.
How did you know it was safe to go? How could you trust that? And where did you go?
When the priest told us that the new government took over.
Okay.
And it was formed, and we have to go out. But there was a group of French soldiers who were in the area saying that they're coming to help Tutsis. So we went in a camp where we stayed for 3 weeks. I mean, in a camp that we have to sleep on the dirt road. It wasn't like a camp where we sleep in the homes or right. on a cement. It was completely dirt. And we would sleep there. We stayed there for 3 weeks. And after 3 weeks, a lady who came there and said that she knew my mom and she was not going to leave me there. So she took me to her house.
Now, where was the rest of your family? What happened to them?
The very first night I came out, I found out that those I left behind didn't make it. Yeah, they died. My mom, my dad, my two brothers, my uncles, my grandma, my grandpa. It was like end of the world. 1 million people died in a period of 3 months.
And that must have been really hard for you to come out and find out. Did a part of you almost already know?
I knew, and I was refusing myself to know. I really kept in denial willingly. I remember outside, they used to say, like, they were only looking for me. Like, they haven't found me. Other people would say that, oh, they found Makile too. So when I heard the rumors that it's possible to make a mistake, I thought that maybe they're making a mistake, that my family died too. So I had to convince my brain, like, no, they're making a mistake. It's not my father they're talking about. Look, they're talking about me too dying. So I knew what can happen, what could have happened. I almost knew, but I didn't want to accept it because I didn't have the right to cry.
That must have been so hard.
Yeah, it wasn't for prayer, if it wasn't that I held on to God, I don't know, I would not have made it. I would have ended the torture. It was too painful.
What did you do after all of this, after the new government was in place?
When the government was in place, I mean, a beautiful thing happened to me, and this is really things I speak a lot about. You know, I went through a huge journey of forgiving and understanding what this whole thing means. I mean, silence for 3 months. So when I came out, I was feeling much more healthier in my heart. I knew I have to do what I can do to be somebody like Gandhi, you know, to put my foot in their footprints, Mother Teresa, you know, Mandela, you know, Martha Luther King, you know, people who have done good. Those were the people who were my hero at the time. And then I couldn't be angry anymore. So when I came out, I was determined to find a job and to do my best to really follow those heroes. And I got a job with the United Nations just a month after. I mean, I had to survive. Right. And I really have to trust a lot. Many times I remember looking for a job and people were like, really? You have one course for the past 4 months. How can you look for a job in the United Nations? And I just have to remember there is a God. And we have to do our best. Doors will open. It's not about me, how I look. It's about me and the will I have in my heart and to hold on and not to give up. And these are the things I've been doing in my retreats, when, you know, my conferences I give for weekends when I do. And I really hope that I continue to share, especially my story, to strengthen people. I get thousands of emails of people who tell me, thank you for making me know that I can do anything. If you can make it, I can make it. And I look forward to continue to share that, because it was another journey. And I wrote a second book about my journey after the bathroom called Led by Faith.
Right. You have like 3 books now, don't you? Is it 2 or 3?
I do have 3 main books and 2 small books. So I have 5 books. But the first one is called Left to Tell, which is the story of the genocide, what happened, how I came out, the strength that guided me, the idea, the thoughts that guided me to survive, and how the whole thing happened, in practically how it happened. The second book is called Led by Faith. It's about 10 years after the genocide, how life came back together, the challenges of being alone and not having your family there, but also knowing that there is that strength of God within from each one that you hold on to, yeah.
It's great that you're able to do something constructive after something so destructive in life has happened.
I hope, I continue to, and I mean, I hope, only because I have seen how this story have touched other people. I have met the leaders of countries who just tell me, thank you, because we can consider more with our decisions before we do take them, yeah.
You would hope so, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, your neighbor, actually, who you have been friends with for years, was Hutu, and he had to go out and he had to kill, and he actually killed some of your cousins, wasn't it?
Yes, that's true.
How did you approach him after everything that had happened?
The process in which I wrote in my book, Left to Tell, and I do speak about this when I'm giving public speaking, I have found that peace in me before I ever met him. So, but there's 2 people. There's one who really grew up as a friend. I met him after he was out of the prison. And I asked him, I'm like, what happened to you? How can you do what you did? He told me, surprisingly, he told me. He's like, do you really want to hear the truth? He said, I miss people I killed. He missed people he killed. He said, I don't like what I did. I don't know what happened to me. I didn't even think I was killing them. I thought I was slapping them. And he said, now it's too late. I wish somebody had told me before. And that was definitely a wake-up call for me, like, whoa. And then another person, I met somebody who was a friend of my parents, who also was in a prison. And we met there, and I offered him forgiveness. And he died in a prison 2 years later. Mm. And that was also another feeling. It wasn't easy. I just was crying for a man who have killed and who had families, who had his wife, his children, and all of a sudden he's in a prison, and you're thinking, how can you do that to yourself? How can you do this to your children? By deciding to make such a thing and go away from your family. And I offered him forgiveness, and it really was a moment, because the head of the jail who was there, he came to meet me later, a year later, and he was really mad at me for forgiving him. And then he told me, he said, that moment changed my life. When he offered him forgiveness, I didn't know it was possible. I was confused and I was mad. And we were able to talk about that more, but it was definitely something that encouraged me to share this with the world.
Right.
Because he told me it changed me. And he was mad at me in the beginning.
That's really good. Well, let's talk about what's going to happen in Minnesota on July 15th, that you're traveling all the way here to the Great Midwest. During summer. It is at St. Mary's Parish.
Yes.
And that's in Worthington, Minnesota?
Yes, Worthington, Minnesota.
Okay, great. Why don't you tell us a little bit of what's going to happen during those 2 days?
You know, those 3 days, I discuss my story. I discuss my story. I mean, it's a three-month story, if not 10 years or lifetime. But I especially want to share the lessons I have learned. What made me think that way? What made me do this? What I think about what happened? How the whole... I mean, there's a history, and there is especially a spiritual journey that I took during that time. How I felt grown up. What can we do to avoid what happens? So I have different sessions I speak about, and of course, is also spiritual to talk about God have for me, who he means for me. And then I let people share their stories. They share their heart. They ask questions. We pray together. We sing together. We dance together. How our country came back normal. And this is really in wonder. We have a beautiful way of sharing. People share a lot. You know, friends sit together for hours and talk. And it's really a great, beautiful thing. And they dance. They sing together. So people where I have done these kind of conferences, retreats, I always love to see people at the end saying, embrace my new life. I am more happier. And there is a lady who was at one of my retreats a year ago. And she had lost a child 2 years before. And she told me, she was with her husband and another child. She never smiled. She had been crying for 2 years. And then when we were together in the retreat and we spoke and we danced together, spiritual, you know, just like a really beautiful song of God, for God. And then she came to me after, she said, not only I smiled, but I danced today. She's like, I found a healing. I am good. I have hope now. So there are many great things that happen in these retreats and people who just healed from this anger and realizing that we can do more. Our life means more than just our pain. And no matter what happens to anybody, there is always hope. There is always hope. I was there. And if I can forgive, anyone can forgive. So I'm trying to share those lessons. And I have seen those retreats touching people in an incredible way I never thought. And I want to continue to do that. So I can't wait to have all these people to meet. Many people have registered already. But we still definitely have space, and we're inviting everyone to join us.
And I think it's important for people to know that you don't have to be Catholic. You don't have to be Lutheran. You don't have to be anything to attend a retreat to renew your faith in humankind and what lessons you can learn and pass on to other people.
Definitely. Oh, yeah. I am inviting anybody. This is a human experience. This is the way we talk about our strength. And sometimes we talk about God, but another person feed God in many different ways or give him another name, but is the same God that teaches us. If I survived, if I can forgive, anyone know what that means. And what God have done to me in my life, anyone have lived something that maybe made them think that way. So anyone is invited. Please, is invited to share with us. We are humans. We are here to share our stories, and we are here to strengthen each other, to learn from one another.
That's great. What a positive message.
Oh, thank you.
It's really amazing that you have overcome all these hardships and that you're able to just go ahead with life and do what you need to do, which is spread your message of forgiveness and faith. I think that's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. And we learn a lot. I share with them how I came to write, you know, I came to learn English. I started learning English when I was in the bathroom. So I think it touches many people in different ways. I remember I had children sending me their diploma, telling me how they were about to drop out of school. And they said, we read your book or we heard you speak and we had to go back to school. We realized that if you can make it, we can make it.
Yes.
So there's a lot of encouragement. There's a lot of people look within when you go to these kind of retreats. You see somebody else's journey, and then you look within, and you realize you have so much strength.
And sometimes you just got to realize that you have to have people point that out to you. You know,
definitely.
You know what I mean?
Or trigger that thought.
Exactly. Well, I hope you have a great tour with your retreats that are going on. And,
thank you.
And I hope you enjoy the Midwest. The food will be good. We do a lot of dairy.
I know, it's amazing. And please, thank you for helping us reach people.
Not
most
a problem.
Of the time, or we go to places and people are like, how come I didn't know about this? Thank you.
Thanks so much for talking to us today. Take care, okay?
You too.
Bye. Bye. A big thank you goes out to Immaculate Ilibigiza for taking the time out to tell us about her story of courage during the 1994 Rwanda genocide. More information about Immaculate and her story, as well as the retreat that'll be coming up July 15th in Minnesota, can be found at www.immaculate.com. That's www.immaculee.com. Thanks for listening to our special presentation.